Say our opening prayer. O Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, Beloved Jesus Christ, Blessed Master, Dearest Mother, Beloved David, Saints and Sages of all religions, I bow to all of you. Free my life from all obstacles, and give me physical, mental, and spiritual development. Make my mind thy temple. Make my heart thy altar. Make my love thy home. Be thou the only king, reigning on the throne of my consciousness. Oh, oh. Peace, bliss, amen. This will do a short meditation here. Tell me if you can't hear it.
Softly and tenderly, oh, Jesus is calling, calling for you and for me. See on the borders, he's waiting and he's watching for you and for me.
About that was the notion that Jesus tenderly, softly and tenderly, Jesus is calling. That's that inner voice, that inner higher capital S self. I love that the Gospels, the Black Gospel, of course, too, which really influenced this kind of singing so much, but the whole business of gospel singing really has that great kind of immediacy of the presence of God, and seeing Him, seeing God personally is a powerful effect. Joe, you can start whenever you like.
Chapter 5, John the Baptist, the Voice of Intuition. Everything in the Bible is written symbolically. John the Baptist came before the Christ, and he represents intuition, the still small voice of God, which comes to the new seeker on the path. John is the grace or the gift of God. This is the meaning of it. This is the gift of God that comes through the intuitive quality of teaching the individual soul or disciple the truth of God. It is that baptism of the Spirit, the one who comes first before the Christ consciousness comes. This is what God revealed to me as being the real meaning. John the Baptist baptizes you with the water of spirit or intuition, and that is just like a river flowing. At first it is spasmodic, and it comes and it goes, and because you are new on the path, you cannot always get the exact meaning, the truth of that which is being given to you. You see, the mind is being used there. The mind tries to understand, and the mind itself cannot understand. You can pick up the Bible and you can read chapter after chapter and verse after verse and try to get the inner truth, the mystic meaning of that which is given apparently as history, and you cannot possibly do it with your mind or your intellect. Man has been so steeped in his darkness, in his ignorance, that he cannot perceive the truth directly. As he studies, as he meditates, as he tries to visualize this light which is within him, he can make great progress if he will learn first to be a witness of himself. In chapter 3 of St. Matthew, it tells about John the Baptist. It says a great deal in here, and we shall try to trace it. Zacharias was the father of John and Elizabeth his mother, and these people were very elderly and had no child. Zacharias was a priest in the temple, and he wanted a son very greatly. And he prayed to God that he might have a son. The word Zacharias means remembered by Jehovah. Zacharias is a symbol of that, because even though he is in old age, when he finally turns his face to God, God remembers him and gives him the opportunity for having the birth of John the Baptist, or the intuitive quality within himself. As Zacharias was served in the temple one day, he went into the inner sanctum in order to perform a part of the ceremony. And as he stood there, an angel of the Lord appeared to him and told him that he and his elderly wife would have a son and that he should be called John. This is what history tells us in the Bible, but the true meaning of it is that this happens to every soul when he comes to a certain state of spiritual consciousness and development. It is that the human self, which usually is not a young age when this happens, because man in his infancy, youth, and middle age likes to live life. He likes to indulge all of his desires, and his mind has not been turned to God. But when he gets to a certain age, perhaps because of certain experiences and events which have happened in his life, he turns his face to God. God has touched him on the shoulder and said, "Now, my son, it is your time that you turn your face away from the world and you come home to me." It is that time that John the Baptist, the intuitive quality of man, starts his work of baptizing with the water of the Spirit. As you listen to this intuitive voice, you're inspired to seek more and more. You're not just wandering around by yourself in the dark, trying to figure things out with your intellect, but rather you are actually being guided by God within yourself. If your mind is always fixed, and if you will listen, he will speak to you. The more you have faith in it, the more you work with it, the more you fix your attention upon God, the more this will grow, because as you practice listening to this intuitive faculty, gradually it develops. This wisdom comes through the trial and error method. You just don't get the answer right away in the beginning, or rather, it can give you the proper answer, but you are not sufficiently developed so that you can understand what this small voice is trying to tell you. Or you choose willfully to ignore it and you go on your own way. You are not yet ready to be about your Father's business. You must test that voice until you see the truth as it really stands. Because anything that does not direct you to the highest of which you are capable of in God is not good. It is not of God. Any voice that directs you to less than your perfection is not the voice of God. Any voice that tells you that you have to be satisfied with the things that you do or say, if they are less than perfect in God, is not the voice of God. So disregard it and test it and say, God, I want only your perfection, your beauty, your power, your wisdom. The way you can tell whether or not you are getting the truth is, does it become prophecy fulfilled? When you feel something very strongly, does it come to pass? When it does, then remember how you felt when God gave you that information. And the next time it happens to you, lean on it a little bit harder. Put a little more faith in it. And pretty soon you will find that this flow will come until you are constantly in communion with him, the inimitable and immutable Lord. God preached in the wilderness of Judea, which is within man, as is New Jerusalem, which is the high state of consciousness. Man has built this tremendous wilderness. It's full of tangles and underbrush and all briars and thorns, and places that are very difficult to get through. The children of God, having come into being in their consciousness, felt separated from God. So then they went out from God. But they must return to God, and so they go through all these various stages in order to return to him. He was garbed in a robe of camel hair, which is very rough. In other words, this is a rough road for this witness to go through, because it is difficult to get the truth of God when he first starts to give it to you in your intuition. This is before the Christ consciousness comes into being within man. John fed on locusts and honey, because when this intuitive voice comes, truly the locusts are there devouring all the good which is in you. The locusts come and they eat up the crops. They are the constant menace, the constant pests, which man tries to get rid of. When the devotee is going through the tremendous experience of climbing the ladder of self-realization, when you are between these two forces, it is as though locusts come. This happens inside of yourself. Mine came in the form of black scorpions. I saw these scorpions all over and they wanted to bite me, and I had visions of them. I wanted to get away from them. But these are the thought forms that come before you and try to tempt you away from God. On the other hand, he fed on honey. And this was when he was taken up into his heaven of his being. The honey, of course, is the consciousness of the Christ. And he was shown great and wonderful things. It's a strange thing. Who can understand it? Except that as you go into this experience, you are lifted up and you have tremendous revelations. These are the angels of God, you can say, the thought forms that God sends you. He opens up your higher consciousness and your subconscious mind, and he gives you a revelation such as you've never even dreamed of. In the beginning, he was baptized outwardly with water. It is a symbolic gesture in the outer sense, of what must be done within man's own consciousness, within his own soul. It is a cleansing property, and in many religions, the whole body is immersed in water, and it purifies the outer body. But also it has a psychological effect on the mind, and there's something very, very special and uplifting in the ceremony which comes forth. This is the outer meaning of the word baptism. But there is a deeper baptism of the spirit, and as the mind and soul are quickened, gradually the spiritual baptism takes place. John comes because he is baptizing our whole being with his consciousness of the Messiah which is to come, this higher self. But as he himself said, he is not worthy to tie the latches of the one who will come after him, the Christ. When Christ came to John, asking him to baptize him, John refused to do this at first because he said he should be baptized of the Christ. And Christ said, "Let it be so now, in order that righteousness must be fulfilled, because you see the Son of Man has to be baptized, and get this very clearly, has to be baptized by John the Baptist, the intuitive voice of God, first, before John the Baptist can be baptized by the Christ, or the eternal Christ consciousness, or God within man eventually." John refers to the higher mind or the intellect, that mind which, having risen in consciousness, is capable of receiving some direction from the divine, but is not yet the consciousness of the Christ. John is the witness, shall we say, and he bears witness to the fact that the soul goes through all of these various experiences. John is the witness of everything that happens to you as you start your ascent from the human being who lived in the animal state, going away from God, fulfilling all his desires, to the human being who is now turning his face to God and is starting the ascent on the spiritual path. Sorry, Larry, I got a little carried away.
Very nice. Nice reading, too. Thank you.
Well, thanks.
I was just thinking as I was listening that because Mother spoke these words, they weren't initially down as a writing, and I think they have extra power being heard because they were meant to be spoken. And I think it's actually gives you a whole different experience listening to them than reading them.
Yeah, very interesting. I remember when I was first with Mother, I was quite, Mother, another book, another thing she used to talk about besides John the Baptist, and these are things that, affected me anyway. She talked about many things. But the things that I remember really being schooled on was John the Baptist being that intuition. How beautifully she says it here that you step out in faith, but you learn to lean on it. I love that. That's a nice way to say it. You learn to trust it. You say, well, my intuition tells me this, and then I'm going to assume it's true or it's in that direction and see where it gets me. And also, others always talked about, some of this stuff was privately told too, so I don't remember if everything will show up in the talks. But she said that you have to step out, you have to take a chance, and you can teach yourself how to see what that feeling is. What is that feeling when this intuition comes? And to blow on that ember, to push that up higher into your consciousness and see if that won't be helpful, and use that tool. At least it can be used to warn you away from things for sure. But it will also lead you into meeting certain people and certain things happening in your life that will be an improvement for you and for others. And then the other thing that comes to mind is that Mother talked a lot about the book, The Power of the Subconscious Mind. And so she tried to teach us how the conscious mind trains the subconscious mind. So the upper consciousness is where the intuition comes from. But the subconscious can be a very good tool for us. It can be seen as a beast of burden if you want, but it can be, Mother always said, you program it, you know, so it's an automation. It just does things automatically. And, you program it with the conscious mind. So those two things really affected me deeply in my first years with Mother.
I liked how she, in this part, talked about being sure to go back and think about how you felt when you had that intuition that was then born out, and how
right.
important that is in our training, and vice versa too.
Yeah.
When it doesn't bear out, what was the experience at the time?
It gets complicated when it's affecting you very personally, and you think, oh, that my intuition is telling me this, but it's something I really want as well, so therefore I'll rely on it. So that is a subtle and it's an important distinction to try to differentiate yourself. And this term that discrimination, which is what the higher mind is. There's in the Western teachings too, but anyway, the Eastern teachings with Sri Yukteswar, there's the manas, which is the mind, and it tends to be things associated with the physical world and through the senses. And then there's the buddhi, which is the discriminative intelligence, which discriminates. And so to train that discriminating part of your brain, of your mind, and how to use it, you can, it's difficult, but you can learn to cut between those things which are true intuition of what is accurate and that which is your own ownership and perhaps too much investment in. That's where it's worrisome, but still the practice is very good to do. And, you know, I think this is why Mother didn't want us drinking or smoking or doing drugs and all these things. This is a continual sadhana that's part of being a disciple. And you really need to stay awake amongst a whole bunch of things that occur. And they happen in chains sometime. A whole sequence of events is laid out. And we need to be Allah, what did Master say? Awake and ready throughout all of this time.
I David talks so much about intuition and how to start to listen to that still small voice of God. And he said it's usually not go buy a Mercedes. It's usually go clean the toilet.
Right. Or it's going to be, if you have a whole spectrum of decision making to be done, it's usually the harder thing to do in that direction anyway. Yeah.
If you're not, that was another one of his suggestions. If you're not sure, choose the harder one and see how that goes.
Right. But you know, even that, you know, can be troublesome in the sense that you can say, well, I just wanted to beat my body or to, you know, we hear these stories of St. Francis and you may realize, no, I was a little bit rough on my body. I shouldn't have done that just to, cause there's an ego connection there too. But of course, the general advice is so true. And it's almost always that we want to go this slightly easier way and then defend it rationally with a rationalization that it was intuition. So, but it's important too. It's important to at least informing yourself that this is intuition, and it's, I know this feeling. I know one thing that Mother, had a dispute with somebody Mother was telling, this woman something that she just said just couldn't be true. And Mother said, when I have this feeling, I'm never wrong. sorry to just, you know, to argue with you, but you, and of course Mother was proven correct on this, but Mother knew, she said, this is something, I know the feeling, I know I'm right on this, so just check out and see if I'm not right. So, Mother was very practiced. And, you know, the thing is, too, with Mother, she had a direct pipeline to God during those years that of which I'm speaking. And so what does that mean, too? But it doesn't mean there isn't resonating effect on the body. And Mother's very familiar with that. And she may have used that description to make it simple. She didn't want to say, I'm to command on high. You know, God's telling me this, which Mother could do sometimes, mostly about herself. But she wouldn't do it that way. Genuinely. The explanation, the allegorical explanation of the locusts and honey is very interesting, isn't it? Mother's got a unique take on that. When you think about it, we've always heard, and if you've been Christian all your life, like a lot of us have been, you've heard that term, locust and honey. What do you think he's? Well, he's just an austere life. He's eating bugs and honey. Well, those are, in our own mind, those are two completely opposing things. There may be nutrition involved in them. There may be food that you can eat, and it's edible, but my gosh, they really are at opposing. And Mother's point is really interesting, I think.
Yeah, I've never heard anything like that before. It's such a, because it is such a dichotomy. Isn't it?
And locusts were associated with the plagues of Egypt, you know. So then you're leaving Egypt to go to the land of milk and honey. So that's an interesting. The Bible has got so much rich thread, so many rich threads woven into it. It's really a wonderful, wonderful resource. But it is also a labyrinth that we can, if without a good guide, we can get lost in it, because, this is where intuition helps with that too.
The story of Elizabeth and Zechariah is one that has always has always filled me with joy. And feeling the baby leap when Mary comes.
I agree. You know, it's funny, in this pilgrimage that Kate and I just took, we were so enamored because we kept seeing the Annunciation was so highly, all the artwork, so much of that. And every once in a while we'd see a Visitation. But those two events really are. But I think, that, you know, it's funny you'd mention this, because David and I used to talk about the Visitation being, you know, really the more powerful, moving thing, that because it's involving two people and the pleasure of knowing they're both having children, and this is some great thing that you could share with somebody else. This Visitation is really, really wonderful. And the artwork associated with it, and the way that it was done in the Jesus of Nazareth show, and it's just a magnificent, magnificent story.
And if you think how John is meeting, how Jesus, John was his guru at one time, so Master says.
That's right.
And so there was the meeting of Master and disciple, and yet in this time, Jesus is the one that's going to go farther, and John the Baptist says, I can't even bend over and tie your shoe.
And yet, if Master is correct, which we assume, he was the one who said, I will give a double portion to Elijah. So, but that's the way perhaps it took place, is they changed spots. I think, you know, this is a collective thing that people, these great gurus, do together. It is very confusing to think that a guru could be a disciple and vice versa. Those are the exceptions. The rule still is the right way to think of things, that you can't be greater than the master, all those kinds of things. That is the rule. You know, John the Baptist too is, well, you know, I think we all do love that show, Jesus of Nazareth, but it has John the Baptist, reading the riot act to Herod and Antipas. So the son of Herod the Great. And, they did some earthy stuff in that. I really love that. And then him being put into the jail cell and Herod coming down and visiting him. Amazing, amazing storytelling. Amazing. And truly archetypal things. Just on the personal level, Mother's teachings are to show that there's more levels than just one to read this at. But yeah, you can see why people are very happy with the outer story itself. It's really tremendous.
I was thinking, Larry, that the only time I'm absolutely sure that it is John the Baptist is when I'm being called to go and meditate. And then it's like, this is definitely God here, you know.
Right.
And maybe it, in another way, if I have a thought that I should do something, and then I see a good outcome, just in little things.
Right, absolutely.
You know?
That's exactly what Mother's talking about.
Yeah. Yeah.
I had a question about the when John was in the womb and he leapt when Mary came up, right, and Jesus was still in the womb. So is that, would that be carrying that allegory or whatever it is through? Is that like your intuition recognizes Christ within you? How would that
work? Yeah, that's a good question. I never heard that. Yeah, never thought about that. Yeah. But of course. Yeah.
Yeah. Very interesting. That the development of the Christ or the guru coming into your life, or the development of the spiritual aspect of yourself, the Christ within yourself, that then brings the intuition to the fore.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, interesting.
Or it's a playing out of these elemental things in the, to use it strictly allegorically, it's a playing out of the, and probably reflect experiences that one has when, you know, the thing about going on the spiritual path is it's several really very important steps that take place in a given life. And so this first twinge is all personal, but the first twinge we have of that this great event is moving forward, is in this lifetime, we're being called to do it in this lifetime, then, you know, it seems like it's going to occur even in the nascent state. Yeah.
I think about when I first met David as an example, and the way he describes me saying, which is when I, within a week of meeting him, and I wasn't on a spiritual path. I was intrigued with the occult and things like that, whatever I was in. But when I met David, I knew there was something within me that knew that what he had was what I was looking for.
Right.
And that has that same, to me, that same resonance of that recognition though. Even though I wasn't, you know, there, it was, but there was that newborn,
preborn
intuition that recognized the Christ consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Beeping in the womb.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the other difference, or the thing that's interesting, and we talked a little bit about last time, was that John was more of an, well, was an ascetic, very much a desert dweller.
Yeah.
And in many ways, to the Jewish mind at the time, those people were where the great prophets came from. So he was esteemed for that, just being righteous in that fashion. But Jesus, and I, you know, it's funny, I don't mean to say that he was a drinker, but he was definitely seen in contrast to John, that he was willing to wade into it all. He wasn't withholding himself. That's the way to look at it, isn't it?
Yeah.
One person was on the outside and living and watching from without, and Jesus waded right into it.
Yeah. Householder yogi.
Right. He came to, this is what the guru is. It's the quintessential notion of the guru anyway. This is, once you know about the Eastern idea of guru and you read the higher understanding and the higher teachings, Jesus is an avatar. He's the greatest guru. He's fits every one of those things.
So in the reading, this is what comes to me, Charmy, from the reading tonight, is when Christ came to John asking him to baptize him, John refused to do this at first, because he said that he should be baptized of the Christ. And Christ said, let it be so now, in order that righteousness must be fulfilled. Because you see, the Son of Man has to be baptized, and get this very clearly, has to be baptized by John the Baptist, the intuitive voice of God first. Before John the Baptist can be baptized by the Christ, or the eternal Christ consciousness, or God within man eventually.
Wow. Very nice.
That was what struck me most in the reading, was that very passage. It really came home to me about the necessity the development of that intuition, that the Son of Man, who I am in my consciousness presently, must be baptized by John. I must develop that kind of a relationship with God within myself in order to go higher in the attainment of Christ consciousness. It's absolutely a necessity.
Yeah.
It's essential.
Yeah, and that's what Mother is saying, isn't it? That this is a necessary, it's a necessary stage we have to go through. And it's a warning also not to go through this thinking we can do it intellectually. There, you have to connect to the feeling aspect, but each of these positions, the intellectual and the feeling nature of the human, is mirrored or is really created by the higher self. And there's elements similar to that. There's the mother always talked about this pipeline to God, but she also, she had both the feeling and the knowledge. So she had it saying, but you have to develop both of those things. For sure, and they play out differently, from the individuals described in here. But you know, the Son of God is reflection, it's a new kingdom come to the new king come to the kingdom. So there's a similarity with what we are doing as a man. It keeps coming to me that man is so, this position we have as being human beings it's so important. And Mother always said the angels have to come down at least once in order to get their full realization. But,
it seems that's the River Jordan is the spine, and the baptism happens at the throat chakra, where discrimination through intuition is born. And then you can ascend to the Christ consciousness of the Ajna.
Well,
I'm not sure if that's how it's supposed to line up, but it just all seems to line up.
So you said the throat chakra?
Yeah. Like the baptism happens there. That's the point in the river where the baptism occurs, and then the intuition is open.
So not to be argumentative, but my mother said that the solar plexus is where the intuition comes from. That's the solar plexus is John the Baptist, but I'm thinking about what you're saying, so I'll consider that as something to think about. What makes you think it would be the throat chakra, by the way? Why do you image that? There's something there, I think.
Discrimination that is able to occur when intuition is unblocked.
Or unlocked, isn't it? Because once when intuition is unlocked from your and John the Baptist waxes, he becomes. That's another thing about the solar plexus and intuition, is that it waxes and wanes like the moon. So it's funny that it's called the solar plexus because evokes the notion of the sun, but it is the moon. These are just basic things that Mother taught about, so I'm not trying to argue with you again. But, so I'm intrigued by the throat chakra. And that you see it there, so is it possible there's more to certainly the River Jordan is the whole spine. And the, meeting place of the solar plexus and it leads into the heart center, which is the first of the divine centers. Then there's probably an element of those two things going all the way up in the chakras.
But you are right. That is what Mother
That's okay.
says. That is the intuition is the solar plexus. So
that's okay. I think you should think what you're saying. I think it's good.
Yeah. There's a difference between intuition and divine revelation, and that maybe where it's getting.
Yeah.
But see, the fifth chakra is the throat chakra is the, when you speak, you know, it is the use of the, and Mother talked about the higher and the lower, the two aspects of the mind too, showing up in different ways. I don't remember now the details. It'll come to me. But at any rate, the idea that there's a subtle, aspect of the mind I think it's ether at the throat center for one thing. And that it's a very subtle aspect. It manifests as a very subtle aspect of the mind. And, should make, the throat center should be reflected in being able to speak, better or be more powerful in speaking. So.
But a realization that happens far after John the Baptist has already come and gone and awakened intuition, and then there's revelations that are occurring as.
Yeah.
And John the Baptist dies at one point too, you know.
Mm-hmm. In fact, he has to die in order for the Christ to start his mission. Because, so let's go through that. That's a good point, Kate. The mother said when John the Baptist's head is cut off, intuition is lost. But then you have to struggle to get to the higher understandings, to gain access to God's mind in a different way, using the upper chakras. And that's the role of the Christ within us is to light up the upper chakras and take advantage of the direct connection to God. So yeah, I mean, it's funny too, you know, so just to go through the moon thing. So she said, if you look at intuition, it varies. Sometimes you have clear intuition and sometimes you don't. She said, that's like the moon. The moon is full and then it wanes and it's new moon, you know, it's completely dark and you lose that. And that is a part of the path, isn't it? The cycles that we go through. Sometimes we have really clear perceptions and sometimes we don't.
I'm wondering about the beheading of John the Baptist and the throat chakra.
Yeah, very good point.
There's something connected with that.
Excellent point, yeah. There's something there. I think there's something there. Interesting. Yeah, why beheading in that way? That's so interesting. Yeah. And he was a voice crying in the wilderness.
And then there's the Bodhi aspect in the throat chakra, isn't there, where the purified mind begins to become.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, from what I understand, occurs around the fifth, sixth chakras. Certainly, it comes, in the sixth chakra. Is Mother always said there's two levels to the mind. And so I wish I could remember in more details. Maybe we can look that up. But there is, it's just not coming to me now. But at any rate, the Bodhi's part of the whole story, when the manas, the disconnect from the mind manas to the Bodhi is what's really occurring. You are established in the Bodhi after realization. But in a way, the Bodhi and the manas both are lower than the full realization point, because they're still dealing with the world, discriminating things that when you've completely realized the dual world is not there anymore. And so, discriminating comes into question as to whether the person who's fully realized though has the discriminative ability that when they work in this plane, they have an enlightened Bodhi, an enlightened discriminative ability. That they can, the Pope is always said to be,
infallible.
Infallible under certain circumstances. I don't mean to make fun of that, but under certain circumstances, when he speaks ex cathedra, he's said to be infallible. And, but there is that a fully realized person literally can be infallible. The mysterious thing about all saints though, they can be infallible and they can be looking wrong in their infallibility. That part of the interaction of a saint with the world is to it's not to hide it so much, but it is to be inscrutable. We are not able to judge them, so we really don't know if what they said was in the words as they described it or in the effect that it has in the world. And I'm convinced that God does things for the effect. He's an active participant in this. He's the action itself. So the effect is what the guru can say the most outrageous things and be, technically wrong about the color of something or whatever it is. But the target is hit directly if you feel it, what they're saying. If you, instead of using the mind to say, well, that's not technically correct. That will take you into the labyrinth. As soon as you let that mind question a saint. Biggest problem, of course, for all of us is knowing who is a saint and who is not. Knowing when you're being tested and when you're not. Knowing when, what to make of these things, what to make of God, what to make of existence itself, ultimately. The only thing we really have, and I feel this, with the Christians so much that what they have is a great, great guru that will pull you through. So. Hold on.
Along that, with that same paragraph, when Jesus says, let it be so now so that all righteousness might be fulfilled, I was thinking, what is the righteousness that he means? And wonder what you would say about that, Larry, but I would want to share that what came to me is that the development of that intuition keeps one safe while one is going through the mystical crucifixion and ascending to those higher states on the way to Christ consciousness. It's so subtle, the difference between the voice of God and true intuition and what comes to you from some lower aspect of your nature, and the necessity for that development of that intuition is what keeps you safe so that righteousness might be fulfilled and that the Christ can then come and become, and one can become the Christ. Right. What is the righteousness that is fulfilled?
Well, first of all, he was the righteous Jew himself. I mean, there's a term in Judaism called Tzaddik, and it lists, just translates as righteous one. So and it's a highly, highly esteemed position to be righteous in the Jewish sense. And a person deemed a Tzaddik, T-Z-A-D-D-O-K, however, there's many different spellings, O-C-H. That is a, I think it's a, Treta Yuga thing, because it's, Rama is talked about being righteous. Krishna, not so much. Krishna is loving and working, and having full manifestation of a realized person. And so during that one phase, during those earlier times before the Dvapara Yuga, the whole notion of what is righteous was important to all of the Greeks, the Egyptians, the Romans, all of these people. They had a background that being righteous was the best measure. And that's why John was loved by the Jews so much. He was seen as doing exactly the most righteous things possible. So I'm assuming that then, that when Jesus, see, I said earlier that Jesus was not an ascetic. So in a Jewish sense, that's why they are critical of him, is because they, you know, he didn't seem to be righteous in that, you know, external way, whereas John was. But he still said no wording in the law will be changed. And he said here that the righteousness, in order to maintain righteousness, that let it be so, that righteousness be fulfilled. So that's a paean to, it's a not acknowledgement of a value which is high in Jesus' understanding. But Jesus had another job to do. He had to do something that was different than that. And in fact, a lot of what Jesus did is show how many people who assumed they were righteous were not. Whited sepulchres full of dead men's bones, and not going in yourself, and but not letting others go in. These things are really severe criticisms of these people, and they were taken that way. He was hated for that. You couldn't mean in this story anyway. It makes perfect sense. He was going right after who was righteous, and them telling him he was not righteous, not following the Sabbath, all of that kind of stuff. Why don't we all love, because it's a great excuse, that Sabbath was not made, man was not made for the Sabbath, Sabbath was made for man. But at the same time, this is a slippery slope. But Jesus was trying to teach something different in a different way.
You know, I have a personal thing with Mother when she actually asked me to take her to breakfast, which, you know, that was a big deal. it was. I still remember how nervous I was. But anyway, so I was totally vegan at the time. I mean, no butter, no nothing. You know, I was totally vegan at the time. And here she ordered. She had sausage and bacon, and then she was just gossiping. I mean, literally gossiping about this person, that person, all the things they were doing wrong. And I'm just like, wow, okay.
And yeah. And then she looked at me because I wasn't any judgment or, wow, what's wrong with you? I was just still so much in awe of her. I was just watching this.
Yeah.
And she said, you need to stick to the path and stick to being ascetic until you cross, you know, go over the top. Then you can just jump right in and do whatever God wants you to do, whether it's eating bacon or talking about people. I mean, she just was just laid right out.
Mm, very interesting, Sherry. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. She was above the law. That's what she was trying to show, wasn't she? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that, and plus I had such a low sense of self at the time. I thought everybody else was the perfect devotees, you know, and nobody ever did anything wrong. And then she was just showing me, Kate, we're all human here, girl. You know, I mean, she was really helping to build me up to, yes, you're on the right path. Yes, this is for you. You know, cause anyway.
Interesting.
But that was that. You know, that ascetic, being ascetic until you don't need to anymore. You know, where Jesus was able to walk in, you said, just jump right into the middle of life, and John wasn't. So,
well, John, they were both doing it from what they were destined, and they were predetermined, whatever that is. But at any rate, that was their destiny to do that. And the outside activity does not bear any resemblance necessarily to what's going on internally. So,
no.
Yeah. Or differences, and they could be at one. Yeah.
Yep. In the allegorical thing, it was, okay, you stay on the ascetic type path and following the rules and everything until you are told not to.
Until your head is chopped off and only the Christ is left standing, because John is now gone. But by the way, just to mention that, she also says it's a difficult time, because when you lose that intuition, and you hopefully by the time you get out to the higher teachings or you start having the higher experiences, you're really trusting that intuition. You've really developed it. And so when you lose it and you know you've lost it, as a dramatic thing, but you have a glimmer, or at least you have a clear pathway already carved out. When the head rolls, when John the Baptist is gone, when you lose that intuition, then you really have to struggle sometimes to hold on to that thread that's coming down from God above. So it really takes huge faith.
That Mother talks about that later in the Dark Night of the Soul chapter. About going through that. But I'm thinking also just in terms of that righteousness, and maybe we don't need to go too much further in it, but that that mother and some of the other saints we've met, it's like there's certain things that you do for righteousness' sake. So this is the tradition, perhaps the religious tradition or societal tradition, but especially a religious tradition. And we do that unless God tells us, like he did with Jesus, where you throw the moneylenders out, or you do something on the Sabbath, or you do something like that. But righteousness being fulfilled, that's how I always took it, is this is the way to do things, and I'm going to do this because it is the right way. And it's part of tradition, and it's the way everybody else has been coming to you, John, and you're baptizing them, and I'm going to do that too. And then, as he came into his own and became the great teacher, and then he sometimes would not do what they thought was righteous.
That's right. Exactly right. Exactly.
But Mother used to, you know, there's certain things that she wanted us to do that were kind of more traditional type things.
Yeah.
Put on nice clothes and come to church and do it this way, men opening the door for women, you know, that those kind of traditional things that's fulfilling righteousness in the way,
And there's a lot of comfort in that, because the rules are known, at least our generation, and you know, the rules were clear, and we were known. We didn't want to live up to them, perhaps, or we did, but we did know the rules, and so Mother was supporting the ones that she thought were important to Mother was focused on society. It wasn't just all about these disciples that she has. She wants society to improve, and she knew that she was coming for that work too.
There's another part to the idea of the throat chakra, is that coming out of the baptism, he comes straight into the awareness of the spirit coming to him, the spirit like a dove descending upon him.
Yeah,
that's and what... Mother describes that as the ajna. And I remember when it just dawned on me, I was in a creche sort of place in on the roadside in Mexico, and I look up at the top of this dome beneath the covering, and there's that dove coming out pure white against brilliant blue, surrounded by gold. And I went, oh, all of the, you know, the images you shared from your pilgrimage, Kate and Larry, of the same image. Churches around the world using that same image. Yeah, and yeah. Here he's describing this coming out of the baptism to that awareness of spirit.
That's a lovely, good point.
Like
very
a
nice.
Dove. And, and Mother's, you know, description that, that the ajna was the mouth of the dove. I'm thinking of it as the whole dove, but she's like, no, it's the, you know, the mouth is open. And
I've always seen the five-pointed star as being a dove-like, similar, similar kind of symbology.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, it's the same. It's one and the same. It's the same thing.
But you know, it's funny. I had that. You just reminded me of some of the, my earliest memories with Mother. That was a question I had, and I never asked her that. Isn't that funny? I had that memory. I have now that memory that I used to think about this a lot, the five-pointed star and the dove being the same thing. I never asked Mother, but that was my experience.
Hmm. And she hadn't talked about it yet.
You know, we'd have to ask other people who knew Mother, and maybe by looking at some of the, what she wrote or what she's, you know, what's been transcribed. But no, I don't know. Certainly she never, I never asked her and got an explicit answer. And it seems important now.
And of course, sometimes we would hear her say things, but it wouldn't go in.
Yeah, yeah.
So, so later, when you've either had some experience or when you actually have prepared yourself to know that, and yet she could have been talking about it.
Well, that's why these transcriptions are so valuable, aren't they? They're just amazing. It's a treasure trove.
I remember once, I'm sorry to divert here, but it just made me think of, I was sitting with Swamiji. And he was talking about the substratum. And I had a whole experience around that substratum. And I said to one of the Westerners on the way out, isn't that amazing, Swamiji, talking about that? He'd never talked about that before. He said he talks about it all the time. And when I read the readings, of course, it's there all the time. But for me, it was then, you know, then that I heard it. And it had, you know, it had meaning for me, so.
Yeah, being around him, it was, yeah, that was a, it's just like so much like Mother, so mysterious. You realize how clearly you think in their presence. I know sometimes people describe being around a saint and you get befuddled. I understand that. I've certainly had that myself. But there are times too where you get, I mean, you know, Mother's way of doing talks was a finely honed thing that she had developed, and it was very, very powerful. So you could really be lifted up and understand, and she would lift people, all of us up sometimes to this clarity and, you know, of understanding things. And now we all put that to a different use though, you know, depending on what we're dealing with. When you get to that upper state, you can solve some of these problems in your own life just by being, seeing the world from that state. So I'm not saying she's teaching everyone the same thing at all. Outwardly, she's teaching all of us the same words are coming out. It's all the same teaching. But inwardly, how those outer words resonate within you, and then also the dialogue, the inner dialogue that we have, in our own mind, and how, you know, this came clear to me, and I've written about it and I've talked about it, but it's an important thing that you know, when I was with Swamiji, it was maybe years of my own development. But I literally could, because it was so clear with him, I literally could hear him outwardly and also hear him talking to me inwardly. But the inward talk was something that I was dealing with. Now, I know that Mother did this too. I know that David did this. When saints talk, and you allow yourself to rest, to let the mind be stiller, to still as you can be, and then the other conversations, the more important conversations can take place, the ones that will direct us to go higher and will give us the great progress that we hope for. Yeah, it's an amazing process. Mother's talks were, it's funny to not be able to explain it to people that people who've been around saints don't have any trouble with it at all. Because it may be different with Mother, but they know that, yes, these people are, they transform you. They really change your life. Just their presence. Mother's hugs were wonderful, but David's hugs were just truly amazing. He put so much effort, inwardly, so much focus and energy and love that it manifested in his hugs that way. I know Mother did the same thing. Everyone always talked about Mother, but it was just so marked as David's attained realization. It's undeniable with him.
And when you listen to one of Mother's talks or David's talks, for me to be able to tell someone else what they said,
yeah,
it was blank. It was just totally blank. It's like, it was a very, very good talk. Very good talk. But what did they say? I don't remember. You know?
Yeah. Well, one thing was Mother would repeat things. So you could, things that Mother repeated, you would catch and get. And because then you knew they were important. And David too. But you're right. A given talk, oftentimes you can't remember. Yeah, that's so true. Somewhat embarrassing for us.
Totally blank. But it was so wonderful. This last talk that you posted too of Mother's. Mm. Oh, I loved every single bit of it. It was amazing.
I loved where she talked about the man in the white nightgown.
Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to say that I remember with Swamiji, I had all these questions that I wanted to ask him. And I would think about the questions, you know, while I was in my room. And then once I was sitting with Swamiji, there were no questions.
This is the thing, isn't it? It's so true.
And then I go back to my room and I go, No,
you have to write them. You have to write them down. Yeah.
It would happen again and again.
See, this is the beauty of, so when you go talk to a saint and you have a conversation, that's different. Nothing wrong with it. It's just different when your mother is giving a talk. Mother's giving a talk and she can introduce any topic that's in the minds of the people. Of her own desire to teach, of God desiring to teach. But it does give her the opportunity to bring up, and we heard Mother answer our questions that we voiced just hours before sometimes. And she would be talking about that in her talk. And again, that would be, if you had this presence of mind, you could ask a saint those questions. But oftentimes you can't. So you're talking about two things. One is, when you get in the presence of a saint, all those things that seemed important before drop in importance just because it just doesn't seem that important. And then, of course, you're saying, too, you don't remember to do so, perhaps. But the other thing is that conversation is different than what Mother did. It was magical. It was magical.
I remember that aspect of you know, going to service and having this whole big thing that I wanted to know about.
Oh yeah, it. Sure.
And then it being just that seemed like what the whole talk was about, was that exact thing.
Oh yeah.
And then talking to three other people who had three other questions, yeah, and they had the same experience. I felt bad because they only talked about what I was interested in. And three different people had the same experience, and we all had three different, completely different questions. So, yeah.
Yeah, David would do that too.
Yeah.
All the time. I think, wow, he just directed all of that at me. I hope that someone else got something out of it.
Right.
Omniscient, omnipotent, and omnipresent. That's how God does it.
Well, another talking about God, how can you know when even every sparrow falls? And she got that realization that it's because I'm there. That's me. That, how would I not know that I in that form died? How would I not know it?
Thank you for that description of the kind of labyrinth and saints being able to say things that to a book are not true. You know, right. Like, is it that helps answer Mira and I's difficulty around some of the biological things that,
right.
You know, it very much speaks to that.
Yeah, this is where we really can't judge saints too much. We have to be careful because, first of all, we really don't know what they're doing. You know, this is such a good story. I'll tell it because, and we've heard it before probably, but it is really profoundly, profound. And this is a story that Mother tells of a person sitting at his desk writing. And, an ant comes up and notices the words going on the page and then discovers, oh, the words are coming from ink and the ink is coming from the pen. The pen is being held by this hand. And then the hand is connected to an arm, which is connected to a person, another entity, but at least they saw the whole mechanism. This is why this is so profound. She said, the ant will never know what is being written. You can understand the mechanics perfectly. But that ant will never have the ability to read those words. It's all in service to that. All of the motion, all of the ink, all of the preparation of the paper, it's all in service to the ideas. And the ant at that consciousness, and this is where we stand, we have to acknowledge when with the magnificence of whatever this is that God has done in this world, we simply are ants looking at words, thinking we understand what he's saying. And we just, it's a wonderful, wonderful story.
And they're not even words. They're little scratches on a paper. Sometimes
it's that abstraction that we're. Yeah,
you look out in the world and we say, God, what are you doing? And really, all we're seeing is scratches on the paper. That's how much our understanding is.
Right. We have to have that humility anyway. God does reveal to us. This is one of the wonderful things that we, the path that we're on, we do have means of realization for the all of what God is doing here, because this is not being imposed upon us. We're owners with this, but the process itself, it puts us in a position of ants, and we take that on. I think it's important for us all to realize that we're all part of the same thing. We took on a veil of ignorance intentionally. We don't, as an individual soul, like individual ego, and that's not true, but it is true about the capital S self within us. That self did know, does know what is going on and what we came for, because it could not be any other way. Simply could not be. We are one with God if we would but know it.
I was thinking that when we were in Mother's presence or in David's presence, it was wonderful because you didn't have to think at all. You could kind of live that realization just by being with them.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah. Contact high.
Exactly.
But more subtle than that. But it's like it is transferable to that extent. They raise us up. They raise us up. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I suppose that would be even more true when you're traveling with them in the desert. You know, caravanning and camping like that, and Jesus' disciples must have felt that way too. Not only are you having the contact high, but every decision, every act that's being chosen, every movement is chosen by a master and you're following. And that is the experience it exactly that the masters have themselves, right? Mm-hmm. But we need this dense form, material form of the body of the master to sense that, to follow what to do every moment.
I just felt like a little child and I was so content. That was just like the only perfect word that could describe being with Mother and being with David. It's just complete content, complete, you know?
Yeah, to be a kitten and not a monkey, huh? As to be, right? Because the monkey has to hold on to the mother, and the kitten. That image that Papa gives is so wonderful.
Mm-hmm. I used to cry my heart out if it wasn't meant that I could be with David, you know, leaving his Mount Vernon place and just sobbing away, and Rick's driving, and Rick is always the same. He's level, you know, and
right.
and here's Judy just sobbing away, you know. Yeah,
it's not just fair, love. Is it? Yeah,
you're sobbing for him.
yeah, for sure. Still do. Today, Ricky and I were sitting on a bench overlooking this little lake, and I see a man going by and he's filled with intent, and I think of David walking, and I said to Ricky, you know, he walked in total peace. He walked in total surrender. Every step, every movement, it was just, surrender personified, and you could watch the surrender and you could feel it when you were with him.
He was a great example of surrender. He really, really was. That's a defining characteristic. Yeah. We'll finish chapter 5 next time. Mm. Please pray with me. Oh, Heavenly Father.
Divine Mother.
I feel the wonder and the beauty.
Of thy glorious presence.
In every part of my being. My heart is bursting with my love for thee. I kneel in adoration at thy feet. And surrender myself to thee. I feel the power of thy perfection. Surging in every cell of my body. My mind and my intelligence.
Are radiant with thy healing light.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss.
Of my communion with thee.
I and my Father are one. Blessed Spirit, I am me.
Oh.
Oh. Oh. Peace.
Peace.
Bless.
Amen.
Softly and tenderly,
mm-hmm.
the Guru is calling.
Mm-hmm.
Softly and tenderly.
Calling for you and for me.
Yeah. Come home.
Mm-hmm. Travis was talking about today when I saw him.
Mm-hmm.
Waiting till I calls, I get to go home. I said, in two ways.
Mm-hmm.
Thinking of that in two different levels.
Mm-hmm.